for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. We live in an increasingly connected world. We've come to rely on instant access to news and information. But some say the sheer volume of what's available has actually weakened our ability to pay attention to anything in real depth. In a new book, author Maggie Jackson details why she believes our high-speed mobile world is eroding our capacity for deep thinking. Her new book is titled Distracted. She joins me here in the studio. Also here is historian and author Rick Schenkman, who argues in a new book titled Just How Stupid Are We? That when it comes to politics, the American public seems to have already jettisoned critical thinking skills. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Rick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Maggie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Maggie, how do you define paying attention?
Well, that's an interesting question. Attention is not just a single thing. You know, neuroscientists are just discovering in the last generation with neuroimaging, et cetera, that attention is a tripartite series of skills. There's focus, which is the sort of spotlight of the mind. There's awareness, which is our perception. When you walk into a garden and you're fully aware of all the sensory beauty of the garden, that's awareness. And then finally, there's judgment. Executive attention, that's called. So attention is crucial to both staying tuned to our environment, which is why humans are interrupt-driven, why we are so, stimuli in our environment is so alluring, and yet we're also trying at always to pursue our goals. So if there's a sort of back and forth, a tension between what attention is, and it couldn't be more crucial to what humans are. It's key to learning, memory, happiness, the development of conscience. It's crucial to surviving thriving in the 21st century.
And why do you believe we are paying less attention?
Well, I think we have, over the course of many generations, even hundreds of years, created a climate of distraction. The technological inventions, even in the 19th century, created an atmosphere of split focus, of hypermobility, the shattering of distance, and we're now dealing with the deepening of these new experiences of time and space. But yet, this freedom and mobile culture that we're dealing with also undermines our attentional powers. Split focus, multitasking, continuous partial attention, that actually cripples our ability to go deeply. And the hypermobility leads to a kind of, you know, power bar, frenzied detachment. A life is a blur.
And yet, what people seem to think they are doing is to pick up lots of facts along the way. You're arguing that there is a big difference between knowing a fact and being willing to analyze that.
Yes, I don't think that we can mistake technological savvy for sense-making and knowledge-making. And there are so many different signs, I think, that we're on the cusp of a very deeply disturbing time of what I call McThinking. You know, the OECD studies of U.S. 15-year-olds, they rank 24th out of 29th in developed countries for problem solving. And 30% of American workers feel that they can't work, they can't reflect on the work that they do because they're so busy and so interrupted. So study after study also shows that youngsters today are technologically savvy but not able to evaluate and assess information on the web. So I think we're dealing with a time where we are doing a great job skimming, grasping. We're dealing with information overload, but we cannot leave behind the difficult, often uncomfortable business of wrestling deeply with thought. And that's where attention comes in.
Maggie Jackson, her new book is titled Distracted, the erosion of attention and the coming dark age. And we do invite your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Turning to you now, Rick Schenkman, you say that with respect to knowing facts, there really has been a genuine decline. Has there been research on that? Where are you getting that?
Well, social scientists have been studying public opinion for the last half century. And, you know, when the surveys first came out in the 1950s, the social scientists were flabbergasted because it turned out the American people didn't know very much about politics, the world, geography, current events. They just didn't know very much, and they were shocked. Then they started thinking about it and thinking about it, and they said, well, there actually are some signs of intellectual life out there. People use shortcuts when they're making up their minds about political decisions instead of maybe reading the newspaper every day and really understanding things. They will at least go to the editorial page in November at the time of an election, see what the editorial writers are saying and say, you know, I maybe don't really understand that argument, but I trust this newspaper. I'm going to vote the way this newspaper does. Or in other ways, they'll kind of pick up little pieces of information. Now, unfortunately, I think that it's actually worse. I think we actually are dumber than our parents and grandparents. And what's happened is, for a variety of reasons, people can no longer absorb the essential information. I use a bunch of studies to try to drive home this point. I call it the 10-alarm fire that we are ignoring about American democracy. If you look at the Iraq War and 9/11, you will understand this. At the time of the Iraq War, a majority of Americans thought that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. Even though there was no evidence of it, they thought that. And they cited that as the reason, the primary reason, not WMD. It was because Saddam was supposedly behind 9/11. They said, that's why we need to topple Saddam and invade his country. A year later, 2004, we get the 9/11 Commission. They come out flat out and say there is no proof whatsoever, no evidence that Saddam had anything to do with 9/11. And still, 50% of the American people, basically a majority, said that Saddam was behind 9/11. Now, if you have a country where the basic facts about an event of the signal importance of 9/11 can't get through to the public, what kind of a democracy do you have? It's very alarming. As I said, it's a 10-alarm fire, and yet nobody's talking about it. And why aren't we talking about it? Because that would mean drawing some questions about the voice of the people being the voice of God. And in the modern age, nobody dares go there. We're all populist now.
We're all populist, which means we need to understand exactly what is going on. And to understand what's going on means that we allow information from a variety of sources to really, really sink in, which is not what's happening, Maggie.
No, I think that there are two ways that we can work forward, and I'm very concerned about what's happening today, especially vis-a-vis our attentional skills, but I'm not pessimistic. I really believe that we're also capable in two ways of cultivating what I call a renaissance of attention, and that would help us deal with both the overload and the frenzy at work and at home, and also with our progress as a democracy. I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville said one of his first worst fears was a thoughtless democracy. And that, of course, according to Rick and what I'm doing, is really coming to pass. And so I think we need to develop both our internal resources. We need to think proactively about attention. We need to learn about it. One of the world's greatest attention scientists, who I spent some days with, Mike Posner, believes that attention should be taught in preschool. And then secondly, we need to dial down the climate of distraction. You know, we don't value pause or stillness. We interrupt one another. We email each other thoughtlessly. I mean, there are ways in both in companies and in schools and in homes that we can sort of clamp down, quiet down this climate of distraction. And I think that will go a long way to getting people the time and the space to start thinking again.
Rick, are you optimistic or otherwise?
Well, my editor made me include a final chapter in the book where I offered at least some optimism. And actually, I'm an optimist by nature, and I do think that there is hope, but we have to anticipate some major changes in the society if we're going to get there. First of all, most basically, I think we need a Sputnik program, a Sputnik-like program for civics in this country. If I were the dictator of the United States, what I would do is I would require every freshman student in college to take a current events quiz every single week. And I think that ought to be something that we're mandating across the Congress ought to be doing this. If you receive federal funds, then all freshman students have to have a current events quiz. I was teacher of journalism in graduate school. And here in Washington, D.C., I had graduate students. They were very bright. They were attentive. They weren't reading the paper. In this graduate class, I finally decided, I'm going to start giving you current events quizzes. They hadn't known who Denny Hastert was 3 weeks after he had been selected Speaker of the House. I said, name the Speaker of the House. They couldn't name him. And I thought, no, this is not going to happen. You're not going to graduate my class and this school if you don't know these kinds of basic informations, because you can't have a real democracy if people don't understand basic facts so we can have a conversation.
Rick wants to include civics in high school. You want to begin the process of attentiveness in preschool. It sounds to me as though we've got revolutionary thought going on here, which I like a lot. Rick Schenkman, his book is titled Just How Stupid Are We? And Maggie Jackson's book is titled Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. Welcome back. We have two guests in this hour. Maggie Jackson is a journalist. She's the author of a new book titled, my book is right over here, and it's titled Distracted. And Rick Schenkman is editor and founder of George Mason University's History Network. He's the author of Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Rick, you say that the fact that we are generally less informed is hidden to some degree by what you call the myth of the people. What do you mean?
Well, because we celebrate the people, we have this idea that the voice of the people is the voice of God. And the problem with that is that it's not often true. In fact, it's probably the exception. The people make mistakes. They make mistakes all the time. But in our society, the way things are configured, we don't draw attention to that. We used to. This is one of the main points I'm arguing in the book, is that a fascinating and substantial and dangerous change took place in the country when Ronald Reagan was elected. And it's not because I'm about to bash Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an optimist, and he showed conservatives that you can celebrate the people, you can be optimistic about democracy, you can be a small p populist, and you can win elections as a conservative. This was a new phenomenon, a new thought to Republicans, to conservatives, to right-wingers. And what happened was, before, you always had the Democrats, the liberals, who were celebrating the common man, but you had conservatives who were drawing attention to the failures of public opinion. After Ronald Reagan, now both sides, both the liberals and the conservatives, were beginning to celebrate the people. And that meant our system was out of whack. You do need to have some institutional reservations about the wisdom of the people. And we've lost that. You don't even get it from the media, because the media is commercial, in, by and large, not NPR, thank goodness, but in the commercial media, they are looking for high ratings. That means they're pandering to the public, and they're not going to perform that function. If nobody's performing that function, then the people go on thinking they're smart. The politicians are telling them they're smart. Where is the group that's going to say, whoa, you're not so smart? Here's what we need to talk about.
Maggie Jackson, there are new tools out there. There are cell phones, there are Blackberries, there are iPods. How do they actually contribute to our learning process, or lack thereof?
Well, I think the new tools that we're facing expand some of the new experiences of time and space that came in with the cinema, the phonograph, the telegraph, the railroad. I mean, distance doesn't matter anymore. Time, it used to be marked in the medieval period. It was controlled and stopped and start in the industrial age of the factory and the school. Now time is layered. We really think we can control time. So these new experiences are wonderful. They give us wondrous advances and access to information. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for equality of learning, and yet they also lead to diffusion and fragmentation. When workers chop up their day, when they're interrupted, it's linked to stress and frustration. Harvard Business Review study showed that when workers are under time pressure, they are only creative when they're focused. When they feel scattered and diffused, they're not creative. So how can we, in an innovation economy, look forward when we have no time to think? And what we need to do is push back and have some sort of middle ground and use our tools wisely. We're not using our tools wisely.
So would you agree with Rick, or bringing these two ideas together, are we not analyzing because we are so distracted? And Rick, are we not learning because we have all these other tools, but we're not getting very deep with them in understanding the issues? We're sort of taking everything at face value.
Well, I would say that I just read a study about 18 to 34-olds' use of tech of the news. And this was done by the Associated Press and a group of anthropologists around the world. And there was a great deal of unease by this age group at their lack of in-depth understanding of the news. But they felt so snowed, so mired in headlines and factoids. They were snacking on the news, but they were unhappy about it.
Snacking on the news, that's quite a phrase, Rick.
It is. I really like it. The age of information is how we like to think about our society, and in some ways it is an age of information. You can turn on CNN, you can find out live time, real time, exactly what's going on. But in fact, I think that we'd be closer to saying, even though this is a stretch, that this is an age of ignorance. The mistake we're making is that we are mistaking access to information for our possession of that information.
Our ability to understand it.
To digest it, which is what Maggie is talking about, and I think it's a great point. The problem is that you've got access to all this information, but if people aren't paying attention in a sustained way, then they're not really absorbing it. There have been study after study. For instance, there's a Pew study from a couple of years ago that suggests, just 2 years ago, which suggests that young people, for all the vaunted talk about young people using the internet, they're into all this new technology, only 11% of the young between 18 and 34 say, themselves are saying, admitting that they consult the internet on a regular basis as their primary source of news. Only 11%. So where are they really picking up their information? Well, they're watching the Jon Stewart show on the Daily Show on Comedy Central, or they're picking it up from their friends, or they're watching television, or they're not really picking it up at all. Yeah. And they're walking around basically ignorant about what's really going on.
And I would say that it's not only a generational issue, that, you know, the fallacy is that technological savvy equals sense-making, knowledge-making. You know, there's a lot more to get in depth. You know, you have to wrestle with a text. You have to wrestle with knowledge. In terms of doing research, one scientist has found that focus is the pivot point of doing research after a long and difficult struggle. But, workers, boomers, older people, you know, 60% of people who've spent 5 years or more on the internet don't know there's such a thing as paid sites, paid and unpaid sites. So I don't think this is quite a generational issue, although we have to be very, very concerned about, you know, the young who are growing up, perhaps without understanding what it means to have an in-depth conversation.
Here's an email from Brad in Heber City, Utah. He says, so by listening to this show while I work, I'm getting dumber and becoming a poor employee. I was going to turn it off, but I got distracted. That's his view. Now, here's an email from Harv, who says, call me an elitist, but I believe an informed electorate presumes educated voters, and a high school education should be required for the privilege to vote. Voters must have the ability to think critically, to evaluate civic, economic, and historical information, topics taught in secondary education. I bitterly attribute the election and re-election of the worst president in U.S. history to unobjective and uneducated voters. Maggie.
Well, I'd like to also add that it's very important to understand that we do need different types of attention, different types of thinking in this new age. For instance, in past centuries, there was the societies valued different types of attention. In the 18th century, there was a sort of rational, enlightened view of observation as being the supreme scientific skill. In the industrial age, we began to understand that attention couldn't be controlled. Hypnosis was a frightening but powerful tool. Dracula didn't just suck the victim's blood; he also used telepathy and hypnosis. And so there was this struggle to control attention. Now we seem to be valuing a nimble, agile form of attention, which is really important, but only in its place.
You
we can't
see
lose.
Kids walking down the street just, you know, using their thumbs. I wonder about the spiritual life as well and what happens to real friendship, the creation of which takes a good bit of time and attention.
Yes, and I think that in many ways, the high connectivity that we're sensing, that having today, is a rich, wonderful resource. And yet, when we can connect with millions of people around the globe, and yet we can't find the time to sit down to dinner with the ones we love, there's something off kilter.
Rick.
Education isn't the cure. Here's some statistics that when I came across them, I was just thunderstruck. In 1940, 6 out of 10 Americans didn't get past the 8th grade. Today, most Americans have had some college. And yet, according to the scientific studies out of the University of Michigan and Columbia and other places, by most measures, people today are no smarter, and on certain questions, like, for instance, spelling out the difference between the Democratic and Republican parties, they're less smart than their parents and grandparents. So education alone, this is the paradox. It can't just be education. It's got to be civics. The problem is, of course, civics sounds fuddy-duddy. It sounds old, gray-haired 19th century. It's essential in a democracy. You had Thomas Jefferson saying that ignorance and freedom cannot go hand in hand. They never have, and anybody who thinks they're going to in the future is crazy.
Here's an email from Julie at the University of Maryland, who says, I have to agree with your guess. I work at a university. The largest problem we see with our students is their inability to comprehend topics and to judge whether information is believable or not. Part of this we attribute to our educational system and teaching to standardized tests. But I think the guests are making a new point that we need to address in our educational system. Maggie.
Yes, I think that, again, we need to teach attention as a skill.
How would you do that in preschool?
Well, there are psychiatrists who are dealing with children at risk for ADHD, and they're using techniques borrowed from stroke therapy. They're using computer games. Everyone knows what attention feels like, what it feels like to focus, what it feels like to be aware of your environment. But actually, if you borrow a little bit of imagery from meditation, meditation isn't about emptying the mind. It's about controlling your mind. I'm not a meditator, but I did learn about this 2,500-year-old technique for controlling one's attention through the research I did, and bringing your focus back again, making the quiet environment you need to focus. I mean, there can be ways. Sometimes preschool teachers even try to develop eye contact. This is a sort of social attention, because focus is not just an important thing for thinking deeply, it's also an important bridge to another.
And Maggie Jackson, her new book is titled Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now. First to Sandusky, Ohio. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. I teach high school English, and I had a question earlier, but then just listening to the course of the conversation for the last couple of minutes, just wanted to bring up something. I've been lucky enough to be a part of some real innovative educational opportunities and programs, and some of the schools that I've helped be a part of are explicit about establishing habits of mind, habits of work, habits of heart kind of stuff, and it goes across classroom disciplines. This is in math, science, language arts, performing arts, and, the common language within the school is critical thinking skills, inquiring, looking for inquiry, an engaged and active and responsible decision maker. And so it's like these explicit tools, this explicit language that we have in our school provides us with an opportunity for the students to reflect on their decisions. And we also, it's also not rocket science that in these schools we have, they're all extended blocks, whether it's a, 80-minute, 90-minute, and multiple places.
Hmm. Maggie.
Well, there are a lot of efforts across campuses also to teach critical thinking skills. And in some part, we inherited an education system that is mired in the industrial age, as we all know, and we need to redo the education system. And the critical thinking skills are being taught in many campuses. There are studies, one study showed the critical thinking skills of college seniors have actually fallen in the last decade, but there are being efforts. It's a really difficult, and there are also efforts across campuses to teach something called information literacy. The trouble is, it's hard to define it. Is it literacy? Is it technological skills? And one national study by the ETS, iSkills test, found that kids scored poor to middling on the first of this kind of information literacy test. However, these efforts are really important. And again, you need to take the time to do this.
Let's go to Hot Springs, Arkansas. Good morning, Claudia.
Good morning, Diane. I recently found myself substitute teaching, and I was in an elementary classroom on leap day, and thought this would be a fun time to talk to the kids, and figuring that surely they knew all about leap day since it only comes around every 4 years. And they hadn't heard of it at all. And I really was shocked. And I'm not a science major. And so I had tried to explain, calendars and planets and orbits and lots of things. And they were fascinated by the whole thing. The election that only comes every 4 years. But I was so shocked that they had not heard of this before.
Interesting. Rick Schenkman, what's your reaction to that? Sort of a basic thing that most people my age certainly grew up with. Every 4 years, there is a leap year.
Well, at least that's science information, and that's tested by the No Child Left Behind Act. The big problem that historians have tried to draw attention to is that No Child Left Behind doesn't include civics, doesn't include history, doesn't include social studies. So if you don't test for it, then the teachers aren't going to teach for it, and the schools are going to be indifferent about it, which is why they've moved away from teaching civics and history and social studies and moved into some of these other areas. So if they don't understand science, we're really in we're up the creek, because at least they're teaching science. They're not even teaching the civics and the history and the social studies anymore, and it's a problem. You know, I want to live in a country of smart voters. And while I don't go so far as to say that I'm living in a country of dumb voters, I do think that the voters aren't very smart. They're not smart enough, and the politicians are taking advantage of that, and that's why our politics are so dumb, and it's disturbing.
Rick Schenkman, his new book is titled Just How Stupid Are We Facing the Truth About the American Voter? We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the American Psychological Association and its 150,000 members, bringing the science and practice of psychology to daily living at apa.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A holiday rebroadcast. Eudora Welty's memoir about growing up in the South reveals how listening helped her become a better writer. Eudora Welty's One Writer's Beginnings, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We've got numerous emails, and of course we have many callers waiting. Here's an email from Michael, who is in Baltimore, Maryland, who says, I cannot disagree more with the premise of your show. I think the talk has not been revolutionary, but rather reactionary. Greg is the most elitist person I've ever heard on the show. Actually, his name is Rick. Both your guests are completely out of touch with the people. Attention has not been lost. It's a new age that requires a new kind of thinking. Rick.
Yes. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Ambrose Bierce, a writer of the 19th century. He wrote something called The Devil's Dictionary. It has lots of great quotes in there. One of his quotes is, war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. Now, that's a very cynical attitude and shows that even 100 years ago, cynics thought there was enough evidence that Americans weren't terribly bright. Today, we've had a war for 5 years in Iraq. Only 1 in 7 Americans, according to a National Geographic survey, can find Iraq on a map. Now, if you haven't taken the time to look at the globe and see where this country is that we have devoted hundreds of billions of dollars to and thousands of lives, I just don't know how you can have a democracy that way. People have to know basic information.
But look at the positive side. There's been a great deal of talk about how much younger people are engaged in this election. But, Rick, I gather you're arguing this is not necessarily a positive thing.
Well, I'm actually in favor of young people being involved because all the studies show that the more involved people are in politics, the more substantive information they wind up absorbing.
But you, Maggie, are worried that they're not delving deeply enough.
Precisely. I mean, I would agree with the caller that we do need a new kind of thinking, but we can't leave old ways of thinking, if that's how you want to put it, new and old, behind. I mean, we need nimble, very agile ways to deal with an information-loaded society. I love to hop around the internet. I get distracted. I go down the little pathways. I move all around the internet. And yet, when it comes to deep focus, I know there's a time and a place for that. I need to preserve it. I need to be able to wrestle with an idea. And I do think that's what's eroding. That's what's being eroding by a total diet. And I'd like to just say one tiny thing about what I mean by a dark age. I studied different turning points in civilizations across time. Thomas Cahill, the historian, calls them hinges of history. We all say, technologically, we're in a new revolutionary new time. So what does that mean? Well, what I found was really disturbing. Dark ages are actually often highly technological. In the medieval era, there was the invention of the compass, the windmill, the mechanical clock, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a time of cultural decline, inevitably. Not only were libraries lost by the 6th century, but the memory of libraries were lost. If we live at the surface of life, if we only react to what's new in our environment, we are entering our own definition of a dark age. And when we can't go deeply in thought or in relationships, when we can't, there are studies that show that Americans, 25% of Americans have no close confidant. And the number of people who are more socially isolated has increased in the last 10 or 20 years. I truly believe that we are at our fingertips. We have wondrous advances, but we just need to use our different kinds of focus and not lose depth.
Let's go to Larry in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I followed the conversation from the beginning of the show, and I'm in total agreement with both of your guests, and I plan to read their books. I just wanted to add some sad reinforcement that for the last 5 years, I thought I was truly out there wandering around by myself and having to deal with people, predominantly young people from grade school and specifically high school and college people, who don't even have any basic idea of what's going on civic-wise, history-wise, what's going on in their own community. And even sadder is they don't seem to care. Their whole life seems to be centered on nothing but the internet and the related electronic toys that go with it. And if you try to have an intelligent conversation of any depth, anything to do with current politics, finances, it's as if, well, what's happening, man? I don't know. I don't know anything about that. And I've experienced this consistently, not randomly. And everybody says, well, you're just not tuned in. Well, I'm 65 years old. I've worked in the commercial news industry. I produced a radio talk show. I've been around the world 3 times, served in the military. I guess I'm tuned in just a little bit. And it just frightens me to think what's happening to us coming down the road.
Rick.
Well, it's an interesting question that you raise, and here's something I think that we have to talk about, which is that when you've got all of these young people involved in technology and they think that they're learning so much, the question really is, what are they learning? And here's what I think they're learning. They're learning how to be a good consumer. This is a consumer society. And they are adept at being consumers, and they understand business, and they understand what it means to be a consumer. But in a consumer society, there is a low priority placed on learning and information. John Dewey, the great 20th century philosopher, predicted what's happening. He said back in the 1920s, in a wonderful book, although it's dense and hard to read, The Problems of Democracy, he said, you know, once we have a fully engaged consumer republic, people aren't going to care about politics because there are going to be too many diversions for their attention. And that's what's happened.
Here's an email from Jim at Florida State University who says, commercial television trains children from a young age to have an attention span of 6 minutes. This is the root of the problem. Europe, for example, has commercials at the beginning of the program and the end of the program, allowing for increased attention and concentration span. Maggie.
Well, it is very interesting. And I don't think that the problem lies only with younger generations. I do want to emphasize that I think this is a cross-generational issue, that the issues of distraction and attention, you know, affect older people, you know, people over the age of six. But the issue of television is very interesting. We've had television for a long time, and yet television has changed. How do we study the influence of television when what is television has completely changed and media itself has broken out of the box? You have kids who are exposed to, on average, to nearly 6 hours of non-print media a day. That's their ether. That's the atmosphere. And that's increasingly ours, too. I visited one scientist who's studying background TV. You know, two-thirds of children under six live in homes where the TV is on most of the time. And he's now studying how this is related to attentional difficulties. Kids play less often. I mean, they play on for a shorter span with their toys. They jump around between toys. And the parental-child interaction in that kind of home goes down 25%.
Let's go now to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this discussion. I'm enjoying it.
Good.
One of the things that I wanted to mention, particularly with regard to Rick's concerns, is there seems to be a need for new thinking, certainly, but that new thinking needs the background and knowledge of history and civics, as he mentions. We talk constantly now about how we don't have any people who know the cultures of the Middle East and Central Asia for diplomatic purposes. We don't have any Arabic speakers. We don't have people who, know the history of world diplomacy and global relations. And, it just seems as though we're going to be bereft of people in our foreign service capacities in the future if we don't have something done about the study of history and the background to these places.
Rick.
Hey, I'm a historian. That's music to my ears. Yeah. I want to require kids to take history classes in high school and in college. Look, you know, Americans don't know much history. We've been allergic to history. That's been a positive in one way. Because we're not preoccupied with the past, it allows us to be focused on the future. It means we aren't like some dysfunctional societies in other places where they're so preoccupied with something that happened in 1300 that they're still arguing about it. But at the same time, of course, as a historian, I say you can't really understand the present or the future if you don't have a knowledge about the past. And it's a cliche, but it's true.
Let's go to Hannibal, Missouri. Good morning, Drex.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a kind of a catchphrase, and I think this is a topic that you should do at least once a month. I think it touches on every show you do in a basic human way. Civics and civility, they don't teach either enough of either in high school or in colleges, and I just finished putting two sons through college, so I know what's being taught and what's not. I think this just goes to the fabric of what's going on in our country. And the gentleman made a comment about a consumer society. And everything material, everything insight at the first level, and don't get any deeper. And I think it's probably got scary parallels to the Roman Empire.
Maggie.
Well, it's interesting because there are parallels to the Roman Empire. I mean, the predisposition of veneer over content, even certain religious and black and white thinking. I mean, when we in a democracy are skimmers, when we only have time for sound bites and snippets of one another, we can't do the kind of nuanced thinking that we need to be democratic. And Russell Barkley, one of the greatest ADHD researchers, calls ADD a disorder of time. People who are impulsive are not able to look to the future. They are captives of what's now, and they are only reacting to what's in their environment. It all goes back to that tension between what attention gives us, the ability to pursue our goals and yet to stay tuned to our environment. We're now attuned to the very second. And I think this also deals with, harkens back to the American propensity to worship efficiency, the business culture, the immigrant culture, the pioneer culture. We worship efficiency. And Frederick Taylor, the great efficiency expert, really taught America, and he had global influence, to chop and fragment work. Well, now we don't make widgets, we're not bricklayers, but we chop and fragment work. We can't see ahead. We can't see the whole.
Rick.
Why do we usually talk in American politics about so many meaningless things? Hillary Clinton pushing back a tumbler scotch at a bar, or Barack Obama's coming in with a low bowling score of 37, or we say Barack Hussein Obama. What is all that about? That's what I'm trying to draw attention to. Why are our politics so stupid? Our politics are stupid because it is simple to have an opinion about all those subjects. You don't need a PhD to understand those subjects. If they start talking about healthcare and really get into the issue, it's complicated, and people get bored and they turn away. So instead, we wind up talking about all the surface stuff, and we talk about myths. Myths drive our politics. Both Obama and Hillary Clinton and John McCain, they all want to pretend to be the common man. Just as George W. Bush wanted to be the guy you wanted to go have a steak at a barbecue with, because people want to see in their leaders a little bit of reflection of themselves.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Albemarle, North Carolina. Robert, thanks for waiting.
How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you so much for putting this topic on the air. I was a little confused earlier. I thought you were focusing more on ADD than anything else, but I have a 15-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter, and I thought I was crazy, but you guys have echoed everything that's been going through my head in the last 20 years. They're being taught to think micro world, McDonald's, Walmart, and things that surround it and affect us immediately. I teach my kids about, when they do watch TV, they watch educational TV. When they hear a name of a city, Baghdad or Tikrit or whatever, we go to a map and we point it out. And to boil it all down, we just moved from Florida to South Carolina, and my 10-year-old daughter had a heated discussion with her teacher, because in one of the textbooks, it's already in a history book that 9/11 was plotted and hatched in Iraq, and that Saddam Hussein trained the people that were involved in it. And my daughter said, no, that's wrong. That all happened in Afghanistan. And she got a heap of trouble because she was, having an adult discussion with a teacher that just would not. And I had to I was called in and was told that my daughter was being disrespectful. I said, look, because it's in a textbook, as she said, it was in the textbook, and that's what we teach. I said, so if tomorrow, if it says the world is flat, we go back to that thought?
I've written 3 books on myths of American history, so it doesn't surprise me in the least that there's misinformation in a textbook. There's page after page after page after page of misinformation in textbooks. That's how I got 3 books out of it. Your daughter is learning a wonderful lesson that you are teaching her. It's unfortunate that all the other students in that class, is my guess, are reading the textbook, memorizing it. Hopefully, they'll maybe, as a result of the reservations of your kid in class, maybe they'll have some doubts, but I doubt it.
Maggie, if someone listening to this show this morning takes to heart your comments and says, because, as you've said, it goes across age issues, how do you begin paying attention?
Well, that's a great question. It seems like a huge mountain. It's a big holistic issue. And yet, there are ways. For instance, give the gift of your attention. I talked to a contemplative who said, when you save a baby and die in a fire, you give your whole life. But when you give your attention, you're giving a minute of your life to something that you deem worthy. Decide what you want to give your attention to. Be a role model for attention. I know that in corporations, this is being discussed. People who are always split focused are telling others that they're not worth the gift of their time. And then also, speak a language of attention. Learn about what attention is.
Maggie Jackson, her new book is titled Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. Rick Schenkman, his book is titled Just How Stupid Are We Facing the Truth About the American Voter. I think you've both written very important books. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.